I think we're done with the slides for now, if that can be turned off. Thank you so much to all of our panelists and to those who preceded us to help produce the knowledge that was presented to you today. These presentations are both challenging and inspiring, as aware of the fast-changing nature of knowledge work as they are pragmatic. Should I do this from here? I've got it. Susan's asked us to offer some thoughts, so I'll do that now by way of synthesis and a little bit of added context, and then let's discuss and interrogate and continue the conversation with a mic that I think will be passed around. So I'll begin, I'll work backwards and begin with Falun Gong's presentation on preserving Ajami African writings and on how he and his colleagues approach this time-sensitive task. His talk gave you an idea of why we at the BU Libraries are doing what we're doing. We are conscious of the need to make knowledge available online ethically. These writings, long neglected by the West partly because of our colonialist disdain for indigenous African cultural heritage, are literally rotting in people's houses. And I'm glad that we can help preserve their digital facsimiles, not to discount the materiality of them. But they will rot and disappear. And what it took for us to get involved in this collection process were a few conversations. That's all it took. I'm so glad that you came to us and that your team came to us, told us about the project, and asked us to provide preservation expertise before the digital images of the manuscripts were ever created, which, from a preservation standpoint, is our dream scenario. And I would love to talk with Ellen more about the colonialist nature of preservation in this context. The story that Dr. Gomes tells, however, has a side that's both that's difficult both logistically and politically. The project is dealing with not one language, but a set of languages, and they all have in common not only the Ajami script, but being labeled as other than Muslim, or in other words, deliberately marginalized, or other than Arabic, I think I meant, deliberately marginalized. When we here in Boston and in conversation with the British Library, both of us representatives of cultures that have done irreparable damage to the African continent, when we talk about preservation, we have to keep this inherent historical power relationship in mind, or we will end up serving no one. But we can't let that paralyze us. Preservation of cultural heritage is important, and it is possible to do it responsibly. So we move ahead with this project and with others, conscious of potential pitfalls and proceeding with caution. These manuscripts need preserving in part because they have been so influential in development of languages all over the African continent and beyond. And they're implicated, as Falou said, in our understanding of ethnicity and human identity itself. Moving on from Africa to China, and Tom Mullaney's excellent presentation, what a wonderful example of storytelling with data. Mullaney delivers on the promise of his abstract to show, quote, that an under-examined potential of DH is to operate at the intersection between radically different scales of human experience, i.e. to help bridge the classic macro-micro divide within historical and humanistic research, and in the space between data and narrative. This is a collaborative digital scholarly project. I am not intimately familiar with the particular team making it happen at Stanford, but generally projects like this have need several different kinds of expertise. Subject expertise, of course, which in this case extends far beyond a single humanities field. Data modeling, information management, and metadata expertise. End user experience expertise, even more essential to a project that aims to be useful to people working in different fields and perhaps coming in with different expectations. Then there's project management, possibly fundraising, grant writing, probably geographic information systems if you want to visualize data on a map. There's editing and the publication process and all of the traditional processes around that. I'm sure I'm forgetting some obvious ones. People with all of these fields of expertise have to come together and find a common language for getting work done collaboratively. And this is where digital scholarship centers like Stanford's CIDR, or Center for Interdisciplinary Digital Research, shine. And there's a reason that they're so often located in libraries. As places where all areas of inquiry come together, libraries, as much as individual disciplines, are agents responsible for generating future possibilities of knowledge production. I want to address what Tom said about, you know, we don't talk about labor. We don't talk enough about labor, that's for sure, but we do talk some, so we should talk about the Digital Humanities Conference that's in Mexico City next year and was in Montreal this year. Questions of labor are relevant with regard to both, with regard to everybody, but in particular, vulnerable populations seem to be students and librarians. We're already talking about this, and I will come back to labor issues in libraries in a minute. What we need now is for is institutionally to take that information and take those conversations and act on them from an infrastructure point of view and from a staffing point of view. Which brings us to Harriet Green, who with her paper takes another step in work she and others have been doing for some years now, the work of reframing how academics outside libraries view librarians. In digital scholarship in particular, librarians are not service providers, they are collaborators. Green talks about libraries as a locus of infrastructure for digital and maybe more generally interdisciplinary scholarship, something that we at BU Libraries have been moving towards since a 2009 conference presentation on which we collaborated with a faculty member, and that's just the stuff that I remember. I'm sure there was work done before that. Green brings in the recent CNI EDUCAUSE report, which calls for a more holistic institutional notion of digital scholarship that comes with a full understanding of the expansive spectrum of roles that libraries take in this work. Acknowledging these roles necessarily brings with it a recognition of libraries as partners in knowledge creation. For what it's worth, most recently before today, I heard the sentiment in an argument made by Alex Hill, who's with us here and will talk tomorrow at the ARL Digital Scholarship Institute that Harriet talked about that took place this past summer. He said, digital scholarship is not a service. Librarians need to be scholars too. And when that got tweeted out, the relevant sectors of Twitter erupted in various versions of hear, hear. The challenge to us of this talk comes as Green moves from a systemic description of what needs to happen to a people-oriented one. How can librarians be empowered, she asks. I'd like to join the chorus of librarians of all specialties and digital scholarship supporters that in that the most effective librarianship is inseparable from scholarship increasingly now. The field and knowledge production in general are changing so quickly that the only effective way to be a librarian is to learn and produce new knowledge continuously. Sounds scary, but I think it's true. And this comes with considerable built-up expertise, and that needs to be acknowledged on an institution-wide level from the perspective of both using the expertise more richly and encouraging its building. Again, we aren't starting from zero with expertise building. Many librarians are pretty good at instruction, and the trainer model that is used by the Digging Deeper, Reaching Further project takes advantage of that well, I think, to propose a systemic way to increase text mining and data science skills, both among librarians and among those that we collaborate with. This is a solid plan. The organizational challenge is in leaving enough time for the human beings involved to truly take this on. Most librarians, ours included, are chronically overworked, as is everybody else in academe. Funding issues mean that by and large, the field has professional development and new knowledge creation relegated to the status of things that we do on top of our work, not as our work. Organizationally speaking, in order to truly innovate, libraries must be able to square our shoulders, take the time and space to breathe, and sit with existing knowledge in order to create something new. So, at the level of our institutional system, which is coming up on a rare moment of immense possibility of change, we need to be asking ourselves, what do we need to get done? And how many well-trained people will it take if all those people are assumed to be allocating a significant percentage of their work effort to learning new things? And how do we then allocate time in advance to projects that arise serendipitously out of all that knowledge building and connection making and protect that time against unpredictable and inevitably overwhelming demands? I do not pretend to have any answers to these questions. Finally, Dr. Ellen Cushman brings her considerable expertise working as an academic with Cherokee cultural heritage to bear on outlining a decolonial framework for translation from those languages to English. The framework is straightforward and both demanding and achievable. Translation must always be approached with a strong cultural context of the original language. This has been true of translation forever and in all languages, particularly when both languages, both the original and the target language, are Western European. But it is only a no-brainer to apply the same standard here if the translator or academic remembers our colonialist and genocidal relationship with Native American peoples and puts all of her experiences in the context of this relationship. This is an iterative, continuous process. Related to these are other ethical issues around knowledge production in which libraries and archives are directly implicated and which Cushman touches on in her work. Who owns knowledge and artifacts? Who gets to tell their stories? Are these people necessarily the same? What are the ethical dimensions of access not only to the artifacts themselves, but to the possibility of weaving a narrative around them? At our core, humanity is the stories that we tell each other about ourselves, and there's immense power in how those stories are told. Who gets to exercise this power? Kimberly Kristen and her colleagues, who also work with indigenous knowledge production systems, in their case of Australian indigenous peoples, answer this through their work on and writing about the Mukutu content management system. That software serves the need of some indigenous societies to tell their stories and manage their digital cultural heritage on their own terms. Specifically, Mukutu provides space for, quote, local cultural protocols to provide granular access parameters. They have created metadata fields for this that can coexist alongside other metadata that are more traditionally created by libraries and archives. And Mukutu supports community engagement through multiple records for individual items, multiple ways that stories can be told. This all comes with a pretty significant reconceptualization of some basic tenets of knowledge production. Kristen and Cushman are two of many scholars who point out that Western notions of ownership, copyright, and access don't always work in other social contexts. They ask us to ask more questions, for example, to talk about the ethics of open access and consider when larger public access to information will hurt already marginalized individuals and groups. Taking this question to its logical extension beyond indigenous knowledge, we quickly connect it to social movements that have used the digital networked medium to disseminate information that has been obscured in many other channels by political interests. Here we're faced with a difficult parallel that was articulated by archivist and anthropologist Jarrett Drake earlier this year between our key responsibility to serve as custodians and disseminators of knowledge and the necessity of, quote, directly supporting citizen anonymity and obfuscation for safety. Walking this line becomes even harder, Drake points out, when we attempt to preserve local languages, taxonomies, and other forms of knowledge that only people within specific communities can decipher. But this is precisely the difficult task before us, to enable the telling of all the truth that harms no one represented by our primary materials. So now it's time for you to interrogate digital scholarship and practice. What questions do you have for our panelists? What connections can you draw to your own research and that of others not present here? What do you think of Cushman's notion of pluriversity? Let's open up the floor. Thank you.